All right. Okay, well, I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation to come to Vancouver again. It's great to be back. So my instructions were to give pedagogical lectures on string theory, and to give very pedagogical lectures on string theory. So if you know string theory, these aren't going to be very thrilling lectures. If you don't know, hopefully you'll get a good idea about what string theory is all about. So I should mention right off the bat that there are lecture notes available for these overheads. They're on the archive at FTH. So you print them out. I'm basically following those almost verbatim. So there are going to be four lectures. The first three lectures will run through roughly the basic ideas of perturbative string theory. Lecture four would be intended to serve as a motivation or introduction to what D-brains are all about. So I don't have time to tell you a lot about D-brains, but in lecture four you'll start understanding why D-brains are important in string theory. Because I only have four lectures, this means that a lot of the technical calculations that are involved in developing these subjects are streamlined, and that means I've left them as exercises for you to do. This is a school, so you should have some exercises to do. The exercises aren't hard, they're just meant to fill in some of the details that I don't have time to run through. Okay, so we'll get going then. Okay, so the first lecture, we're going to just start basically from scratch. We're going to do classical stuff today. I'm going to start by giving a very non-technical overview about why we're interested in string theory. What are the failures? What are the prospects? What has string theory accomplished? I'll do this very quickly, just a brief glimpse through a history of string theory. Then I'll start telling you about how to quantize, well, how to study the dynamics of a relativistic particle, which you all know how to do, but I'll probably might do it in a way that some of you haven't seen before. Namely, we'll go and look at a first quantization approach to particle kinematics. And the reason for doing that is that that technique will easily generalize to more complicated objects, extended objects like strings and higher dimensional brains and what have you. And then once we do that, we can go and analyze the classical dynamics of strings, look at the string equations of motion. So everything today is going to be classical, and tomorrow we will get on to the quantum theory. Okay, so we'll start with a brief run through about... Yeah, it looks a little... Okay, so we'll start through just explaining very non-technically what string theory is about. Well, what is string theory? Well, what is quantum field theory, conventional quantum field theory? Well, in quantum field theory, the fundamental objects, the quanta, are just points. They're point particles, and mathematically they're described by points in your space-time. And string theory is a generalization of this idea, a radical generalization where you replace that point by a one-dimensional extended object. So the fundamental objects are these lines. The lines can be open, they can have two endpoints, or they can be closed up into a loop. And the idea behind this is that the different elementary particles that one observes in nature now are the different vibrational modes of the string. So you imagine the string is oscillating there. It has different modes of oscillation, and those different modes correspond to the elementary particles that we observe. And so this is the idea that came out after the late 1960s, the so-called dual models of hadron resonances. String theory was really set in to describe hadron physics. Okay? And there were good evidence that string theory S scattering elements reproduced what was understood in meson scattering experiments at the time. And the, again, there are these towers of particles, massive particles, which sit on things called Reggie trajectories, and this was a real state of the art at the time. And this is sort of the picture that emerged in particle physics at, by around 1970. Well, that was okay, but around 1973, the interest in this subject started to fade. The main reason it faded was that quantum chromodynamics came into the picture, and it was immediately recognized as the correct quantum field theory of the strong interactions. Besides that, string theories were found to possess many undesirable features that aren't observed in hadron physics. For instance, there were lots of extra dimensions, more than four space-time dimensions. This was needed to for the mathematical consistency of string theory. There were also extra massless particles, other than the gluon in the spectrum of the string. And these were massless particles that were not observed in QCD. So about a year later, the interest in string theory came back, but it came back for another reason. So one of these massless particles that I just mentioned was a spin 2 massless particle, and it was found to interact like a graviton. Okay? This spin 2 particle mediated gravitational interactions. So what this meant now was that string theory naturally has embedded into it gravitation. So it was proposed then as not a theory of hadrons, but rather as a unified theory of all the fundamental forces, including gravity. And this is in marked contrast to what happens in quantum field theory, because in quantum gravity, Feynman diagrams are typically plagued by severe non-renormalizable ultraviolet divergences. So I've drawn a schematic scattering amplitude here, where the brown lines are gravitons, and these things are ultraviolet divergent, and they're non-renormalizable ultraviolet divergences. Whereas, on the other hand, string theory is completely free from these ultraviolet divergences. So string theory is a well-defined quantum theory that requires gravitation for its overall consistency. So you put these facts together, and you can go and estimate what the characteristic length scale of strings are. So it's a relativistic quantum theory that includes gravitation, so it should have a length scale that's set by three corresponding fundamental constants. And that's the speed of light, c, the Newtonian gravitational constant, g, and the reduced Planck constant, h bar. You can combine those quantities into a number that has dimensions of length, and that's called the Planck length. And its value is of the order of 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, which is, of course, very small. You can compare that with the typical size of hadrons, which are of the order of 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. So this is, if you wish, one of the string theorist's arguments as to why we haven't observed strings yet in nature, because their length scale is so small. But if you feel better with energy scales, you can go and write down the corresponding mass associated with this length. It's called the Planck mass. It's of order of 10 to the 19th GeV. And that's, of course, very high. It's so high that we can't observe it in present-day experiments. But at energies very much smaller than these scales, strings are accurately described by quantum field theory. So the idea is that a string is so small that we're very far away from it. All we really see is its center of mass motion. It looks like a particle. So all we can see are its vibrational modes, and these are the elementary particles that we observe in nature today. So what are the general features, then, of string theory within this context? So this is stuff that came out, say, in the late 70s, what we understood about string theory. Well, at very high energies, the ordinary Einstein theory of general relativity is modified by stringy corrections. But at ordinary energy scales, at the ordinary distances that we can observe, the general theory of relativity in Einstein's form is there. just as we understand it now. So that was the first feature. The second feature was that Yang-Mills gauge theories came out in string theory. And they had similar features to the standard model, but they weren't quite the standard model. In particular, it wasn't understood how the usual gauge group of the standard model should be selected in string theory. And finally, string theory is a theory that predicts supersymmetry. It requires supersymmetry for its overall mathematical consistency. And this is a genuine prediction of superstring theory that has not yet been discovered experimentally. So with all this, string theory began to show great promise as a unified theory of the fundamental interactions, including gravity. Well, things were quiet for a while, until about 1985, when something called the first superstring revolution set in. What happened in 1985 is that it was understood how to cancel certain mathematical inconsistencies that string theories possess. This was an anomaly cancellation, the Green-Schwarz anomaly cancellation. The upshot of anomaly cancellation was that it left us with five consistent, well-defined superstring theories, each of which lives in 10 space-time dimensions. And I've written down what those five theories are called, and by Friday you'll understand where this terminology comes from. So the five string theories were type 1, type 2a and b, SO32 heterotic, and E8 cross E8 heterotic. These theories have Yang-Mills gauge groups associated to them. They have gauge theories living in them. In the type 1 theory, there's a Yang-Mills gauge group SO32. The type 2 theories have an abelian U1 gauge group. One of the real interests was the E8 cross E8 heterotic string, because you could construct phenomenological grad unified theories based on that. So these live in 10 space-time dimensions, so right away you have to ask yourself is how do we reconcile the 10 space-time dimensions with the 4 space-time dimensions that we live in. And the reconciliation of that was brought through by the notion of a compactification. And the idea of a compactification is that the strings are living in a 9 plus 1 dimensional space-time, but 6 of the spatial directions in that space-time are curled up onto a very small 6-dimensional space. And then there's a remaining 3 plus 1 dimensional world that's supposed to be the world that we live in. This small 6-dimensional space is not arbitrary. It was restricted by string dynamics to be something called a Calabi-Yau manifold. And all these theories had tantalizingly similar features again to the standard model, but again there was no definite quantitative agreement between the standard model physics and physics predicted by string theory. So towards the end of the 1980s, string theory began to die down again because of the lack of quantitative agreements with the standard model. The other reason it began to die down was that it was only really understood as a theory in the perturbative sense. We only understood how to formulate string theory through divergent perturbation series, analogous to what you usually do in quantum field theory. But you know that to describe a realistic vacuum in quantum field theory, it's unlikely that perturbation theory is going to be the whole story. A good example of this are QCD instantons, which are relevant to the description of the QCD vacuum. So to have a real good understanding of the string vacuum, we need to understand how to go beyond perturbation theory. And that's what wasn't understood for a while, until around 1995, with what's dubbed now the second superstring revolution. So what happened in the second superstring revolution is that it was understood how to go beyond perturbation theory. And the main idea which came into play here was the notion of a duality. And a duality, very roughly, probes non-perturbative features of a string theory. It allows you to go from a perturbative regime of one theory to a non-perturbative regime of another one. There were three major consequences of the second superstring revolution. There are many of them, but the ones I want to focus on here are as follows. First of all, it was understood how to relate all five of these superstring theories together. And that's good, right? Because if we want to have a grand unified theory of all the fundamental interactions, there should be only one such theory, if it's a unified model. And what was understood now is that these seemingly five different string theories that we have are really the same theory. They're just different perturbative expansions of some larger theory. So you have some larger theory that I call curly U, and you go write down its equations of motion, and its equations of motion can admit many consistent solutions. And what these five different theories are, they're just different solutions to the equations of motion of this larger theory. So that was a nice picture we had. The second feature of this theory U was that it admits a solution in 11 space-time dimensions rather than 10, a solution that's called N-theory. And the picture we now have of these five superstring theories looks as follows. So here are the five theories that I've written down living in 10 space-time dimensions. Here's this new theory that lives in one space-time dimension higher called M-theory. Now, formally, M-theory was found by looking at the strong coupling limits. GS is the string coupling constant. So if you look at the strong coupling limit of the type 2-way theory, or the E8 cross E8 heterotic string, what you find is that the theory essentially grows another dimension, and it puts you into this framework of M theory. Equivalently, we can get back to the 2-way or E8 cross E8 theories by performing what's known as a T-duality transformation on M theory. And we'll discuss T-duality on Friday. So a T-duality transformation, this basically means you take one of the dimensions of your space-time and you wrap it, you compactify it again. You wrap it on a circle or a finite interval, and you do a transformation which inverts the size of the circle or the interval. And that'll take you back down to these theories. And then the various superstring theories in 10 dimensions can be related to each other by doing T-duality transformations in 9 dimensions. So again, you curl up one of the 10 space-time dimensions on a circle, do this transformation which inverts the radius, and this will take you between either the 2-way or 2B theories or the two types of heterotic theories. And finally, the type 1 theory and the heterotic SO32 theories are related by what's called S-duality. This is just a generalization of the well-known electromagnetic duality in four-dimensional gauge theories. It just inverts the string coupling constant. So this is the sort of picture we had now of how these different superstring theories are interlaced. So a schematic picture of this space of string vacua could be perhaps drawn like this. You have your theory U sitting here, and it's got different perturbative expansions, which are depicted by these nodes. So you have the five string theories and M theory at another node, and about each of these nodes here, a weakly coupled string description is possible, right? Around each of the nodes, you can do perturbation theory. But there's a bigger picture underlying these five superstring theories. Okay. Now the third discovery, a very important discovery, was that this theory U also admits a variety of other non-perturbative excitations which have even larger spatial extensions than a string. These are called P-brains, where P is an integer telling you the number of spatial extensions that the object has. So a string is P equals 1. It's a 1 brain. A particle is a 0 brain. And a very important class of P-brains were things known as Dirichlet P-brains, or D-brains for short. D-brains the dynamics of D-brains are under control because their quantum dynamics are governed by the theory of the open strings which attach to them. So a picture of a D-brain looks like this. It's just some hyperplanes sitting in your 10-dimensional space-time. And its relevance is that these are the objects that open strings can start and end on. And we understand how to write down the dynamics of the open strings themselves, and those dynamics induce dynamics on the D-brains themselves. So why were D-brains so important? Well, I could go on and on. I'll just mention a few. But first of all, they really gave explicit realizations of these non-perturbative string dualities. Namely, we can look at a theory A and a closed string state in that theory. By a closed string state, I mean this is a perturbative state. So its amplitudes will vary. They'll be analytic functions of the string coupling constant GS. And then we can apply this S-duality transformation that I mentioned. Right? It takes you from weak to strong coupling. It takes GS to 1 over GS. That gives you another theory where the amplitude will vary like 1 over GS. And if it goes like 1 over the coupling, it's a non-perturbative state. And that non-perturbative state is exactly described by a D-brain. So they gave explicit realizations of these duality conjectures that related these superstring theories to each other. They also provided a microscopic counting of black hole entropy for black holes in string theory. There was the famous ADS-CFT correspondence. Very roughly, ADS-CFT comes about because a D-brain has two dual descriptions. In one description, it has gauge fields living on it, so you can describe it using gauge theory. And another description, it's solutions of the superstring or supergravity equations of motion. And if you demand that these two descriptions be equivalent, then in some very special instances, this tells you that string theory is equivalent to a gauge theory. So this gave explicit realizations of the old ideas that Yang-Mills theory can be represented as some sort of string theory. I just mentioned a couple more. They also allowed us to probe very, very short distances into space-time. So D-brains can see very, very, very short distance structures where we don't understand what general relativity means anymore. The structure of space-time deteriorates. Classical general relativity breaks down because now at these length scales, quantum gravitational fluctuations become very important. But D-brains gave us a way to get a handle on that. And there's been large radius compactifications, the idea that the extra compact dimensions in string theory could actually have some observable consequences. And there have been now brain world scenarios used to explain things like the hierarchy problem in string theory, and so on. So I don't want to go through that much more. So that's the overview of the sort of theme I want to focus on in these lectures. This is what we're going to work to. We won't have time to talk a lot about D-brains, but by the end of lecture 4, you should have a good working idea of what where D-brains come from, at least. Okay, so now we're going to start the real stuff. We're going to start getting quantitative. We're going to go work towards now writing down how to describe the dynamics of strings. And as I mentioned before, to do that, what I want to do is go and revisit the relativistic particle. And I want to revisit it in a way that you're usually not introduced in a first year course in quantum field theory. So we're going to look at a massive point particle and first quantization. So this is a sum over histories approach, which is intimately tied to perturbation theory, and it allows us to quantize the theory straightforwardly. So what is this? So what is a point particle? Well, a point particle is a point, and the point moves in your space-time. So space-time is on the right here. There's a trajectory that the particle follows. It's parametrized by a coordinate tau, which is some real number. And this line that tau lies along is called the world line of your particle. So the world line is mapped into your space-time by some functions, x mu of tau, and these describe the motion of the particle in your space-time. So as tau increases, the particle moves along its one-dimensional world line. Okay? You know that. So what we want to do now is let's write down the path length swept out by the particle. We write down an infinitesimal patch of length along this world line of the particle. Okay, so over here on the world line, there's some infinitesimal element d tau, and from the embedding functions, there'll be a corresponding infinitesimal element dl. So that it's known how to write that down. You just write down the induced length element on this trajectory by this formula here. And I'm just defining notations here. Eta is the Flatt-Minkowski metric. I'm assuming that my particle is moving in an arbitrary space-time dimension, which is d. So I haven't fixed d to anything yet. So we've got this invariant path length swept out, and what we want to do now is we want to define an action principle for the particle. And what we take for the action is we take it to be the total length of the particle, of the particle's world line as it moves in space-time. So it's the integral over all of these Lorentz invariant path lengths, and then you put in its mass parameter to make the action dimensionless. So that's how we define it. And then using the embeddings, using these formulas here, you can of course rewrite dl in terms of the embedding functions x mu, where the dot denotes differentiation with respect to this world line time parameter. Okay? And this is the right thing to do, right? This is a free particle, and you know that the classical dynamics of a free particle are described by geodesics in your space-time, the trajectories of the least length. So if you extremize this action, you apply the variational principle, its extrema will describe, its minima will describe geodesics of the particle in space-time. So that's the working principle. And indeed, your first exercise is to show that this is the correct thing to do. So show that the Euler-Lagrange equations associated with that action just give you the usual equations of relativistic particle kinematics. So P is the momentum here, and the equations of motion just tell you, of course, that momentum's conserved. It's a free particle. Okay, now this action has a very special symmetry, has a symmetry known as reparametrization invariance. And it's associated to this Einstein constraint from relativistic particle kinematics, right? This constraint tells you that p squared, the square of this momentum, is equal to minus m squared. It's the Einstein equation. Now that constraint is equivalent to some Noether symmetry of this theory, and it turns out to be equivalent to a sort of gauge invariance of this world line theory. So what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is I can take this coordinate tau and replace it by any function, any other function of a new time coordinate tau prime. And the condition on the derivative here just ensures that it's an orientation preserving transformation. So I do that, and what you find is that the action just looks the same when expressed in terms of tau or in terms of tau prime. So this is a symmetry. It's like a gauge symmetry. It's a symmetry under redefining the world line coordinate. So if you're clever enough, you can find a nice transformation that simplifies the form of the action and the equations of motion and allows you to describe things more explicitly. So in other words, it allows us to select a convenient gauge to analyze the dynamics. This is a very important point that we'll exploit when we do strings. So let me give two examples of what you can do in this simple particle case. So, well, one gauge you can take is called the static gauge. So you just take, what you do is you assume that the the world line direction is aligned with the time direction of your space-time. Okay, so x0 is tau, and I'll just call that t, because we can really think of it now as a time. And then you just plug this choice into the equations that we wrote down before. So your action now takes a very simple looking form. It's just square root 1 minus v squared, where v is now the velocity of the particle as it moves in space-time. And the equations of motion that we had in exercise 1 just tell you again, of course, that the momentum's conserved. But now your momentum in this gauge takes this very simple and familiar looking form from relativistic particle dynamics. So when you first do special relativity, this is usually the equation you see for the relativistic momentum. Okay? So this agrees with everything we know about special relativity. There's an even simpler gauge choice, though, that doesn't look as familiar, but I can demand that this combination, x dot squared, be equal to minus 1. Okay, now you go again, look at the formula we had for the momenta. You find that this means that the momenta is equal to m times essentially this velocity. So it doesn't look right. It's looking non-relativistic now. The equations of motion, again, momentum's conserved, so x double dot is 0, and that's by these linear Galilean-type trajectories of the particle. So there's an even simpler gauge choice, which makes things look sort of non-relativistic, but the point is you can play around with this symmetry that you have to simplify the action to a form that's convenient for calculation. Okay, so that's the particle. Let's now go and look at the string. We're going to do exactly the same thing. We had a point before. Let's replace that point by a one-dimensional extended object. Okay? So, again, there's going to be a time parameter, tau, describing the motion of this one-dimensional extended object, but now there's another coordinate that I call sigma. And sigma, of course, just tells you where you are along this one-dimensional object, along this string. So sigma is the coordinate that tells you where you are along the string. And for simplicity, I just assume that sigma lies in a finite interval whose endpoints are 0 and pi. You don't need to do that, but that makes things a little simpler. So again, the string now, this is what we'll call now the string world sheet. So the particle had a world line. The string will have a two-dimensional world sheet described by these two coordinates, tau and sigma. And I'll often use this notation psi 0, psi 1 for the world sheet coordinates. Psi 0 is tau and psi 1 is sigma. So again, there are embedding functions that take this world sheet and map it into space-time. They give you some surface in space-time. And that world, as tau increases, the string, this one-dimensional object, follows its world sheet in the space-time. And again, sigma, the other coordinate sigma, just tells you where you are along this string. So it's exactly the same idea that I had before. So now we want to go and take this picture, and write down some variational principle that reproduces, that will tell us the classical dynamics of the string. And we follow the same approach that we did before. We had the particle, we wrote down an infinitesimal length element on it. We have a surface now, so things are a little more complicated. What we need to do is write down a formula for an infinitesimal patch of area on the surface. Okay, so in the world sheet, you have an infinitesimal area element d squared psi, and there'll be a corresponding area element on the surface in space-time. Now in the space-time, as before, we've got this flat Minkowski metric. I'm looking at the simplest possible space-time. But on the actual world sheet, there's an induced metric. And there's a well-known formula how to write down an induced metric on an embedded surface. And the formula is written here. You just take these embedding functions, differentiate them with respect to these world sheet coordinates, and then contract them in this fashion with the Flatt-Minkowski metric. So this is now the metric that's sitting on this surface in space-time. Using that metric, it's an elementary exercise in two-dimensional geometry to write down a formula for the infinitesimal area element. And there's a typo here. There should be a d squared psi there. Okay, so we have, again, we have this area, d squared psi on the world sheet, and then dA, the corresponding infinitesimal area element here. You take this induced metric, work out its determinant. So you assemble this metric into a 2x2 symmetric non-degenerate matrix, take its determinants, non-zero, and take the square root. That's just a standard formula for the induced infinitesimal area element on it. So you know this infinitesimal area element. Again, do exactly what we did for the particle. We said the action was given by the total length of the particle's trajectory as it moves in space-time. Now replace this with this extended notion for a string. We'll define the action to be the total area swept out by the string in space-time, the total area of its world sheet. So it's just the integral dA. It's multiplied now, again, with some parameter t that makes the action dimensionless. And then I just substitute in this formula for the induced area element in terms of the embedding functions x, and we find that the action takes this form. So that's the string action. That's what we're going to build on. And we're just following exactly the same principle that we knew from elementary particle dynamics. Well, what is this parameter t that sits there? Well, before, when it was a particle, we had a mass. Now this is a quantity that has dimensions of mass per unit length, and now it's the tension of the string. So this is a string, and it has some tension associated with it. The tension is related now to the intrinsic length scale of the string. So this is some string, and it has some typical size that we call LS. Okay, and it's related through these formulas. T is 1 over 2 pi alpha prime. Alpha prime has dimensions of length squared, and it's exactly the square of this intrinsic length scale. Alpha prime comes about from historical reasons. It's from, again, these dual resonance models for hadrons. It's something called the universal Reggie slope, and it's a slope because in the old dual resonance models, the massive particles sat on these linear trajectories, and the trajectories themselves had slope given by this quantity alpha prime. Okay, so that's completing the definition of the string action. Your second exercise is to show that this action I just wrote down is reparametrization invariant. So show that if you redefine the world sheet coordinates, psi goes to psi prime, then the action takes the same form when expressed in either of the coordinates. Okay? And as we'll discuss momentarily, this allows us to take some suitable gauge choice that makes this action look very simple. Well, you can write this action a little more explicitly by just working out the determinant. It's a 2x2 determinant, so there's a simple formula for it. And you'll find that the action takes this form, where x dot is the derivative of x with respect to the world sheet time, tau, and x prime is the derivative with respect to the world sheet space coordinate, sigma. And you find the action has this form, and this was one of the original forms of the action. It's what's called the Nambu-Goto action. Now that's fine. The problem right now is that there are these square roots floating around in these formulas, and these square roots are cumbersome to deal with. There's a very elegant way, however, to get rid of the square root. And this is the famous observation due to Polyakov. There's a way to eliminate the square root. What I can do is I'll write down another action that now depends again on these embedding fields x, but it depends on another two-dimensional non-degenerate tensor gamma on the world sheet. This sits on the world sheet. Okay, so it's an action written like this. HAB, remember, is the induced metric on the string world sheet, so it has this expression in terms of the embedding functions x. And this is called the Poiokoff action. This is the Poiokoff action. Gamma here, the way gamma, you see gamma appears in a covariant way. It's really acting to make this expression covariant, so we can really think of it as a metric on the world sheet, an arbitrary metric sitting on the world sheet. And just notation again, by gamma I mean the determinant of this 2x2 matrix again. And with that, when I raise indices, I mean the inverse of this 2x2 matrix. So why am I writing this down? Well, the point is that if you now go and eliminate gamma from this theory, so you've got this action depending on x and gamma, and we want an action depending only on x. So we can get rid of gamma by varying the action with respect to gamma, working out the equations of motion, and substituting back in the value of gamma I get from the equations of motion. And that's indeed, if you do that, it's left as an exercise, you'll find that this action reduces to the Nambu-Goto action. Okay, so that's your third exercise, is to take this action, vary it with respect to gamma AB, and show that the equations of motion look like this. With respect to the variation in gamma AB. So there's this quantity TAB I've defined here, and the condition is that quantity be equal to zero. That's the equations of motion. So that's the first part, show that happens, and then use this equation to eliminate gamma. So you can solve this equation for gamma, and you see gamma appears quadratically here, so whatever you find for gamma will naturally involve some type of square root structure. And show that indeed if you substitute that value for gamma back into this action, you get back this Nambu-Goto action with the square root in it. Okay, this is not a hard exercise. But this was the beautiful observation of Poiokoff, that you can get rid of that square root. You've got this action now, and this action looks very simple, in fact. It looks very simple because it's really... This looks almost like some type of free field theory, right? It's just quadratic in the derivatives of this field. So it's a very simple looking action. And this is now the action we're going to work with for the rest of these lectures. Okay. This mention in passing that these constraints I've written down here are often referred to as Virasoro constraints. And we'll have more to say about that later on. Okay, let's go and look at now the symmetries of this theory. Okay, and now when I'm talking about a string action, I'm going to be constantly referring now to this Poiokoff action. Because this exercise tells you that, at least at the classical level, the Poiokoff action is equivalent to the Nambu-Goto action. Now, this quantity TAB that you get from varying this action with respect to the metric is actually the energy momentum tensor of this 1 plus 1 dimensional world sheet field theory. So this is a field theory defined on a 2 dimensional space. So it's a 1 plus 1 dimensional field theory. So it'll have some energy momentum tensor associated to it, and that's precisely what this guy is. And we've imposed a constraint on it. The constraint on our theory is that the energy momentum tensor vanish. And again, just like the Einstein constraint, this constraint is equivalent to writing down some type of Noether symmetry of this field theory. And this time, it's equivalent to two types of gauge symmetries of the Poiokoff action. The first one is the one you already know. It's this reparametrization invariance, the invariance of the action under a change of coordinates on the world sheet. The second one is somewhat more profound. It's called veil or scale invariance. It allows you to rescale this two-dimensional metric that sits in the Polyakov action by some other arbitrary function. I write it in an exponential form just to emphasize the fact that it's some positive function. So I can rescale the metric by any positive function on the world sheet. And that's known as vowel invariance or scale invariance. Well, we already knew that the action is invariant under these types of transformations. You can trivially show that it's also invariant under these types of transformations. Okay, if you replace the metric in the Polyakov action by this quantity, you just find that this piece drops out. It never appears. So what we can do now is use the invariance of the Polyakov action under these two symmetries to select a convenient gauge, just like we did for the particle. And the gauge I'm going to constantly work with is what's called the conformal gauge. Okay? The conformal gauge is just, we use the scale invariance here to write the world sheet metric as some multiple of the flat Minkowski metric on the world sheet. Okay, so A to AB is this two-dimensional Minkowski metric, minus 1, plus 1. And then there's just some factor, e to the phi, sitting in front of it. Okay? This is what I call the conformal gauge. It's a very simple choice. And now you see what happens. You put this into the Polyakov action. This conformal, this factor sitting here, which is usually called the conformal factor, just drops out because the action's invariant under it. And what you do now is you rewrite the Polyakov action using this flat two-dimensional Minkowski metric. So your Polyakov action now has a very simple form. It just looks like this because you contract everything with this flat diagonal metric. Now the constraints TAB equals 0 also take a very simple form. They can be split up into two components like this. And this is now the Polyakov action in the conformal gauge. Okay, it's with this special gauge choice. Of course, everything I'm saying here is classical. You have to worry about whether any of these symmetries are broken at the quantum level, but we'll discuss that tomorrow. Now, I have to emphasize, though, that when we come to the quantization, look how simple it's going to be. It's really simple. If you just forget about these constraints for a moment, this is just a free field theory. And you know how to quantize a free field theory. You quantize a field theory with infinite families of harmonic oscillators. It's absolutely trivial to do. The real meat of string theory comes in, though, through the constraints that you impose when you quantize a theory. So the quantization is very simple. The real novel physics that comes out of the quantization of this two-dimensional field theory lies in the imposition of these constraints.
The two constraints are right from the y.
I'm sorry?
The constraints are right from the
function. Yeah, you vary it with respect to gamma. And that gives you a constraint. It's because this is, again, you have a type of Noether symmetry in this two-dimensional field theory. Okay, so that's the setup. This is now the action that we're going to be looking at. The Polyakov action in the conformal gauge, and now let's start using it to look at string dynamics. So we're going to go and look at the string equations of motion. So we just do the usual thing, the standard practice. Take this action here and vary it with respect to the axis. Write down the variation of it. So we do that. We vary it in the with respect to the x's. Gamma is now fixed, right? I've used the symmetry to fix gamma to this choice here, the conformal gauge. And now I vary my action. And you find that generically you get two terms in the action and the variation of the action. There's the first term here, which gives you something that's essentially just the bulk equations of motion, the equations of motion of this two-dimensional field theory on the interior of this world sheet. To get to this form, though, what you have to do, though, is take a derivative that was hitting x and integrate it by parts to get the two derivatives paired up here. So there's always some kind of integration by parts that you do. So what I've done is I've tacked on this extra boundary term, which is what you get from doing the integration by parts. So that there's actually two contributions to this, to the variation of this action. Okay, so this is between the two endpoints of the string. Remember, the string generally just has two boundaries, two endpoints. So that's where this comes from. So to set the variation of this action to zero, we have to do two things. We have to ensure that this bulk term vanishes, and also that these boundary terms vanish. Now, demanding that the bulk term vanishes gives you something familiar. The bulk equations of motion, in this case, are just the two-dimensional wave equation. All right, it's just the Laplacian on the string world sheet acting on x equals zero. Just the usual things you would get for a free field theory. But now you've got to worry about the boundary term. So the solutions of the classical equations of motion correspond to solving this two-dimensional wave equation with an appropriate set of boundary conditions that assumes that this boundary variation here vanishes. And the different types of boundary conditions depends, crucially, on whether you're talking about closed strings or open strings. This is where the distinction starts between closed and open strings. There hasn't been any distinction yet. So what type of boundary conditions can we do? Well, let's look at closed strings first. Well, closed strings, what do? We want to take the two ends of the string and tie them together. We want to close the string into a loop. That's what we mean by a closed string. And we do that by just imposing periodic boundary conditions on x and its spatial derivatives. So the world sheet now looks like an infinite cylinder. Okay, I've taken sigma, I've tied it, wrapped it up onto a circle, and now tau still runs between minus infinity and infinity. Okay, so the world sheet is an infinite cylinder. So that's closed strings. What about open strings? Well, with open strings, there's some more degree of freedom here. You see, you can do one of two things. You can either demand that x prime be zero at both of the endpoints, or you can demand that delta x be zero at both of the endpoints. And you could have mixtures of the two, of course, but I'm not going to discuss sort of mixed types of boundary conditions. They won't be relevant for what I say. So the condition that x prime is zero is called a Neumann boundary condition. This you know from the theory of partial differential equations. The condition that delta x is zero is actually equivalent to just saying the time derivative of x vanishes. Right? Because if the time derivative of x vanishes, you can integrate this equation with respect to tau, and you find that this x is equal to some point in some point in space-time for all tau. So x dot equals zero is equivalent to saying delta x is zero, because it fixes x at something. And these are just Dirichlet boundary conditions. And you can, you know, going back again as a prelude to what's going to happen, I mean, I said that this is fixing x at some space-time location, and that space-time location turns out to be a physical object called a D-brain. The D is for Dirichlet. Okay, so those are the two types of boundary conditions. Now, the open string world sheet, sigma just lies on some interval now, right? It has two endpoints. It's just an open string. So your world sheet now is a semi-infinite strip rather than a cylinder. Okay? And for the next three lectures, for the rest of this lecture and the next two, I'm only going to focus on Neumann boundary conditions. We'll talk a bit about Dirichlet in the fourth lecture with this on. Okay. So how do we solve? So we have this wave equation to solve for either closed strings or open strings, given boundary conditions. And what we do is we'll solve now the wave equation using things called mode expansions. So we'll take the wave equation first and rewrite up here and rewrite it in terms of these world sheet light cone coordinates. So I've just introduced new coordinates, psi plus or minus. These are just the light cone coordinates on the world sheet. And then the wave equation has a very simple form that looks like this. The advantage of this is that I know how to solve this equation now. The most general solution to this equation can be split up into the sum of something which depends only on psi plus, because then d minus of it is 0, plus something which depends only on psi minus, because d plus of it is equal to 0. That's the most general solution of the two-dimensional wave equation written in these coordinates. So now we have to impose boundary conditions. For closed strings, remember we want periodic boundary conditions on both the string and its derivative. And you can show that these two types of solutions admit a Laurent series expansion, which looks like this. Okay? Now, it looks complicated, but it isn't. I mean, I'm just writing down a Laurent series expansion, the most general type of function that depends only on psi plus or psi minus. There are factors of alpha prime inserted here just for dimension reasons. So the L and the R subscript refers to left and right movers. Okay, something that depends on psi plus is a left moving solution. Something that depends on psi minus is a right moving solution. And that's because these types of solutions describe exactly that. They're solutions of the wave equation, and they each describe left and right moving traveling waves around the closed string circle. So these are traveling wave solutions of the wave equation. You can go and integrate up each of these functions with respect to sigma. You find that all of these terms are gone. And you find that x naught and p naught have the interpretation of the center of mass, position, and momentum of the string. So you just average the string's position over this circle, and you find that that's what x naught and p naught are. For p naught, you need to take a time derivative, of course. The infinite sums that appear here are the contributions from the oscillatory modes of the string. Okay, so there's a center of mass motion described by the leading terms, and then a bunch of oscillatory stuff. So the alpha n's and alpha n tildes are the oscillatory modes, the vibrational modes of the string. Okay. Just solving the wave equation. Okay, now this is my last overhead of the day. What about open strings? Well, there's an easy trick that you can use to get the solution for an open string. It's something called the doubling trick. It's the simple mathematical observation that, so my open string is described by some open interval, open finite interval, and the simple observation is that I can obtain an interval by taking a circle and identifying opposite points on the circle. So formally, I identify sigma with minus sigma on the circle. And that, of course, if you identify opposite points, it squashes your circle into a finite interval. So in other words, I can take the closed string mode expansion and impose a further constraint on it. I can say that x mu a tau sigma be equal to x mu a tau with the reflected sigma. I identify these two functions. Note that this extra condition automatically satisfies the Neumann boundary condition. If you take a time a sigma derivative of both sides of this equation at sigma equals 0, then it just tells you that x prime mu is minus x prime mu, so it has to be 0. So that extra condition is consistent with the Neumann boundary condition. Put it into there, work it out, and now you find this type of mode expansion. Okay? This type of mode expansion. There's only one now for an open string because I identify left and right movers. And what does this describe? Well, what I've done really is I've taken these left and right moving traveling waves and I've identified them. And when you do that, your traveling waves turn into a standing wave. So now the open string mode expansion describes a standing wave on this circle. Okay. So that's the solution of the classical equations of motion. That's all done. The last thing you need to do is understand what the constraints look like, these mass shell constraints that the energy momentum tensor vanishes. So you want to rewrite those in terms of the mode expansion. So first of all, what you do is rewrite the energy momentum tensor in terms of these world sheet light cone coordinates. What you find is that the components T minus plus and T plus minus are just identically zero. It's just an identity. There's nothing interesting in it. For the other two components, T plus plus, which is D plus X squared, you find the following mode expansions, where the Ln and the Ln tildes are defined by these two quantities here. And I've defined alpha naught tilde and alpha naught to be some combination of the center of mass momentum of the string. There's two different equations depending on whether you're looking at closed or open string. And these two symmetries, the fact that these two quantities have to vanish, corresponds to, again, it's some infinite dimensional symmetry, right? Because this mode expansion gives you infinitely many constraints, and this is called the local conformal symmetry, which preserves the conformal gauge condition. Okay, what does this mean? Well, it means that the conformal gauge condition that I used to write down the Polyakov action in the conformal gauge is invariant under these types of transformations, under replacing psi plus by an arbitrary analytic function of psi plus, and similarly for psi minus. Those are called conformal transformations, and this observation is the basis of the conformal field theory approach, conformal field theory in general, which is one of the most powerful techniques that was developed in the 1980s for studying perturbative string theory. But that's the classical theory all done, and tomorrow morning we'll start looking at the quantum theory. That's it.
Here at 10:15.